My father was one of those people who are most comfortable at the fringes, away from the action center stage. He did not need or crave attention. Instead, he was driven by the need to reassure others that everything was going to be all right. Belvin Norris Jr. was a fixer, an eternal optimist to the core. You could see it in his smile. As a grown man, he still grinned like a schoolboy, and you could not help but grin along with him. His vibe was contagious. Kindness is usually seen as altruistic, but it can also be an act of desperation, satisfying a deep-seated need to avoid the mind's darker places. Benevolence, for some, is a survival tactic. Even in his last hours, my father practiced benevolence, always looking out for everybody else. Moments after the doctors delivered devastating news about his health, my father, still smiling, pointed to an infected cut on my left hand. It was his way of prodding the emergency room physician to turn his attention to me, the victim opting to be the benefactor. Dad took ill in June 1988 while visiting his brother Simpson in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The minute he called me, I knew something awful had happened. His voice was graveled, his words rubbery. He couldn't put a sentence together, and the failed effort only added to his frustration. He had lost control of his speech, but he managed to hold on to his sunny disposition. Although his words were incomprehensible, I sensed a false cheer, with each attempt at speech ending on an elevated note, the kind of verbal leap parents of very young children use to mask irritation or fear. I was working as a newspaper reporter in Chicago at the time. Dad had stopped by to visit me on his way to Uncle Simpson's house. We had spent a few days going to baseball games and trying to get my kitchen in order. He was relieved to see that I'd finally learned to enjoy spending time at the stove. I showed off for him with jambalaya and pineapple upside-down cake, and it worked. He set aside small talk, went back for seconds, and still had room for a huge piece of cake. When he was finished, he dabbed his mouth and said, "Maybe now you'll find someone who will put up with you." To another person, this might have sounded like a dig, but I knew what he meant. I could use my kitchen skills to cook at home and save money and to help close the deal when I found the right man. I was 26 and living on my own in Chicago, no husband, no roommate, just me in a second-story duplex apartment with high ceilings, a large kitchen, and actual furniture. For years, my father had visited me at various apartments where the most comfortable chair had been either a wooden crate or something recovered from the curb on trash day. He never let me forget an embarrassing episode when I was living in Southern California. A neighbor stopped by my Manhattan Beach apartment to borrow a coffee filter one Saturday morning. She couldn't stop staring at the wing-back armchair in which my father sat reading the Los Angeles Times. "You know, Michelle," she said, "that looks like the chair I threw out for bulk trash pickup a few weeks ago." My neighbor left with her borrowed coffee filter and a piece of my dignity. Lucky for me, my father had a sense of humor and a strong commitment to thrift. He always believed that the prettiest car on the road was the one that was paid in full. And in his book, the most attractive chair in my cramped living room that day was the one that had arrived without a price tag. We had a good laugh, and when he left, he snuck an envelope in my jewelry box with sofa fund written on the outside. My father preached that he would always help me as long as I helped myself by working hard and spending smart. I was better at the former than the latter, and when he visited me in Chicago in June 1988, he saw that I had earned high marks on both fronts. He appeared healthy during that visit. A week later, when I got the call from Indiana, it seemed like I was talking to a man I didn't know. As soon as I put the phone down, I started packing a bag. I had to get to Fort Wayne fast. By the time I arrived, Dad had already checked into the hospital. The doctors there didn't know exactly what was wrong, but they knew that something was very wrong, and that most likely it had to do with his brain or his central nervous system. The doctors spoke among themselves about anaplastic astrocytomas and radiation therapy. It was a code that could mean only one thing: cancer. Even in the most terrifying moments in a sterile hospital, there is some comfort in knowing that a world you recognize is just outside and beyond the parking garage. You can fixate on a familiar image as a doctor shaves years off your life with each sentence. He can talk all he wants about therapies and operations, but you're thinking of the parking lot where you taught your daughter to drive, or the gas station that uses red reflective press-on letters to spell out a different Bible verse each week, like the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. While the doctor yammers on, you're thinking of the grizzled gas station attendant who climbs the ladder to change the sign and wondering what pearl of wisdom he might offer in light of the news you just got. In Fort Wayne, in a large hospital in an unfamiliar city, we were confronting an unknown illness that had swiftly robbed my father of his ability to carry out the most basic functions. We were looking at complicated surgery and, at best, a long and complex recovery. So the doctor suggested that we quickly move Dad back to Minnesota, where he could be treated closer to home.